Hello and welcome to Fourth Friday, a KCIW News Magazine show. Over the next half hour, we'll talk to Curry Health Network CEO Ginny Williams and update you on that new standalone emergency room in Brookings. Also, what makes a smart reader? Here's a hint. You need books and volunteers. And take a look outside. The daffodils are blooming, and that means it's time to talk dirty. Paul Otto of the Brookings Harbor Garden Club will be along with advice on what to do right now in the garden. It all happens right now. I'm Lori Gallo-Stoddard in the KCIW Newsroom, and this is Fourth Friday. We begin today's program with a disturbing story about money and influence right in our own backyard. The state of Oregon said no to the Jordan Cove liquid natural gas pipeline yet again on February 19th. Oregon's Department of Land Conservation and Development believes the proposed export terminal in Coos Bay is bad for our coastal resources, endangered species and habitats, and for fisheries and commercial shipping. The Jordan Cove Liquid Natural Gas, or LNG, project has been controversial since it was first proposed in 2005. It is backed by government officials, including State Representative David Brock Smith, but has been successfully blocked three times by local environmental and tribal groups. But we're just now learning that the people who objected to the proposed pipeline were being closely watched by Coos County Sheriff's officers. Those officers were being paid by the company that wants the Jordan Cove project built. It's a large Canadian energy company named Pembina. Aileen Brown is one of the reporters who broke this story for The Intercept. She's on assignment in New York right now, but spoke to KCIW by phone.
So I worked on this piece in collaboration with another reporter, Will Parrish. So we knew that Pembina was providing funding for this sheriff's unit within Coos County, but we didn't really know what that looked like. And basically what we found, how Pembina essentially paid for an entire unit of the Coos County Sheriff's Office for about 4 years. But it's remarkable that this sheriff's office was accepting this funding for so many years before this project was approved, you know, and it still hasn't been approved.
And according to Parrish and Brown's reporting, the Coos County Sheriff's Department paid for more than just a few deputies with Pembina's money. It also bought riot control equipment, including a sound cannon for nearly $50,000, and paid for social media monitoring software and for training about controlling the narrative when it comes to big pipeline opposition.
This training was paid for by Pembina, but coordinated by the National Sheriff's Association as well as the Coos County Sheriff's Office. I mean, this is sort of where some of my reporting came in, because I mean, Will and I both have reported quite a bit about the security response to the Dakota Access Pipeline, the pipeline that was at the heart of the Standing Rock movement. A couple of the characters that we'd run into through that reporting sort of appeared as trainers at Oregon law enforcement officials. Two guys in particular, Robert Rice and Nate Johnson, had been involved in some sort of questionable organizing in response to the Dakota Access Pipeline and another pipeline in Pennsylvania, where they weren't only creating propaganda for the internet, but they were also kind of organizing or attempting to organize folks on the ground. I obtained some audio from a meeting that this propagandist, Robert Rice, held with local community members in North Dakota who had, for a period, organized in support of the police that were policing the Standing Rock movement. But this character, Robert Rice, really desired to kind of keep this counter movement going. And he suggested at one point that they sort of organize a group that could be called Mom Against Violent Activists, and they could go on tour across the nation and share their story. And he suggested that it was the oil industry that might pay for this.
Here is Brown's audio of Robert Rice speaking at that North Dakota meeting.
Sponsors, I'm sure a lot of companies would throw money at this. And then you just travel and hit all the great big, the new pipeline cities. And
we do GoFundMe.
When you preface it with the moms against something, I'm willing to bet you could probably, I'm completely speculating. You could probably, if you did it right, you could probably get anonymous donations from interested parties.
Probably.
Cough oil, cough. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and then you spend a summer or you spend a fall and you just travel, you have a lot of time, you've live blogged the whole damn thing. The protesters will hate you for it.
Shit.
But you'd be famous and you'd be like, well, yeah, we founded the Moms Against Angry Violent Activists. And Fox News would be like, we want to talk to you.
So, again, it was just disturbing to see this character and another appear in Oregon offering training to law enforcement. These two guys also were formerly consultant for this security firm, this really mercenary security firm called Tiger Swan, that had received, a whole lot of backlash for their militarized operation in collaboration with police in North Dakota and their really invasive surveillance practices.
Tens of thousands of Oregonians submitted comments opposing Jordan Cove to state and federal permitting agencies. There was large grassroots opposition to the project, and the Karuk, Yurok, Klamath, Siletz, Roundtable, and Talawadani tribes have also all passed resolutions opposing the Jordan Cove project. And according to Brown and Parrish, they were all being watched. They say Pembina provided the Coos County Sheriff's Department officer training on how to use propaganda against protesters, and that Coos County deputies also coordinated intelligence gathering operations with private security companies that worked directly for Pembina.
So, just seeing them there at this training that was Pembina funded in Oregon raised a lot of questions about what kinds of tactics law enforcement officers are learning at this in these industry funded spaces. Imagine they paid for 5 sheriff's deputies to work full time for almost 4 years, and they were saying over time they're going to be employing 20 to 25 sheriffs. It's clear that the funding translated into more monitoring of pipeline opponents and more funding in preparation to respond forcefully if there were sort of Standing Rock style protests. For example, they had one sheriff's deputy that was running this this email list that included officials from a lot of different law enforcement agencies kind of monitoring extremism in Southern Oregon. And a lot of the emails that were exchanged involved Facebook posts, for example, from opponents of Jordan Cove and talked about meetings that they were having. As in June, Pembina put funding for the sheriff's office on hold. They said they were reviewing some of their expenses. And in the wake of that, the Coos County was able to continue funding these 5 sheriff's deputies until December. But once December hit and these guys were forced to be absorbed into other departments, one guy retired, their involvement with that email list ended. So it's clear that without that funding, there's simply less monitoring. And I did want to underline also, so this funding has been on hold, but Pembina and the sheriff's office have been in talks about renewing the agreement down the line. The sheriff underlined to me that he believed that they were moving forward and that would happen. Of course, if the pipeline if the project is entirely canceled, I can't imagine that Pembina will continue to provide funding.
Even though Oregon has repeatedly said no to the Jordan Cove liquid natural gas project, it doesn't necessarily mean the project is dead. The Trump administration supports the project, and the U.S. Commerce Secretary could still try to preempt Oregon's authority. Our thanks to Aileen Brown for speaking with us, and to her fellow reporter Will Parrish for their work on this story. Again, this piece originally broke in The Intercept, and full disclosure, The Intercept is known for its highly factual reporting outside of the mainstream media. Still to come on Fourth Friday, take a look outside. The daffodils are popping and so are the calla lilies. That means spring and gardening, so it's time to talk dirty to you with Paul Otto from the Brookings Harbor Garden Club. And we all know that working outside in the garden is good for your health, but what happens when you don't feel well or you need immediate medical care? Well, the healthcare landscape here in Curry County has changed over the past few months. KCIW spoke with Curry Health CEO Ginny Williams to find out what those changes mean to all of us here in Brookings. The Curry Health Network opened the very first standalone emergency room in Oregon in early December here in Brookings.
Yeah, we are seeing a lot of sick patients.
That's Curry Health CEO Ginny Williams.
We had our fair share of flu this season, like everybody else, but we are seeing rule-out cardiac patients. We are seeing pneumonias. We are seeing diabetes, foot ulcers, and I mean, we are seeing just the whole gamut of your typical emergency room kinds of patients that require inpatient stay to come and be transferred up here. But I think the most significant thing, Lori, is that we have had, in January, we transferred 36 patients. I don't have to the location, but what I do know is that we're able to transfer directly to either Asante or Bay Area for those cardiac patients that really need to get into a cath lab. And in, I think it was earlier, it was in December, we actually were able to transfer somebody for the first time out of this county and get them to Asante and into the cath lab within 60 minutes. So I don't know the outcome of that patient, but I have to tell you, that's pretty incredible, and that's great coordination between, you know, CalOR, our team, and Asante being just ready for that patient. So we are definitely seeing ER patients in that location. They are no longer just urgent care patients.
You probably know the New Brookings ER is housed in the same building that used to be home to Curry Health's urgent care clinic. Curry Health had originally planned to replace urgent care with the new emergency room, but that's not what happened. Today, there's a same-day appointment clinic as well as the ER on 5th Street. Why? Well, money. Cost for a typical visit to an ER starts at some $1,200, and an urgent care visit is a whole lot less money. Folks here said they didn't want to lose that less expensive option, so Williams says Curry Health made a decision to offer both an emergency room and an urgent care-type clinic at the same location.
When we first started talking about opening an emergency room down in Brookings, we were going to convert the urgent care and have all of that business, in addition to any new business, fall into that emergency room. But in listening to the public, and they're having a strong desire to have a less expensive option, similar to an urgent care, where they could be seen that day for less for non-emergent but rather urgent things. We did open up a same-day clinic, so that's been good. People have been able to access. People have commented that they like to be able to make an appointment rather than come and sit and wait in the lobby forever to get into urgent care.
And how many folks are using the new emergency room in Brookings?
We anticipated that we would see approximately 33 patients a day in the emergency room down at CMC. And we're seeing just shy of that, on average, 30 patients. We've seen as many as 48 on given days, but when you average them all out, we're seeing just about 30. So we're just shy of our numbers. What we have seen an increase in beyond what we projected was our admission to the hospital and the number of patient days, both for inpatient and for observation. Those numbers have gone up about 23% from prior to having the emergency room open.
Williams is counting on the money generated from the Brookings emergency room to help Curry Health's bottom line. And so far, the numbers for the ER seem to be close to projections, but the Curry Health Network still has a ways to go before it's operating in the black.
We are very, very close to what we budgeted. But unfortunately, the rest of our business in the last 2 months has been slower than budgeted. And so the overall numbers, we have yet to hit our budget targets, both from a revenue and we're definitely higher in our expenses. So, but again, if you teach just the emergency room and looked at it standalone, it's very, very close to what we budgeted.
Well, one of the things that you talked about in November, Ginny, was the fact that you were having this bridge loan from, I think it's from AllCare.
AllCare, and I was concerned about paying that back in 1 year.
Correct. Are you on target for that? Does that feel comfortable?
Yeah, we'll make that. You know, the function of needing to pay that back in a year is that I really didn't want that loan to hit our long-term debt. Our long-term debt is beyond capacity of where it should be on our balance sheet. So as long as we pay it back within those 12 months, then it's considered, you know, short-term debt, and it doesn't hit your financial ratios as significantly as leaving that 1.2 on the book. So we have, I think, exhausted most of those funds from AllCare and have already been making our payments per schedule. So, yes, but that, and that's included in the ER budget.
What's the possibility of adding a hospital to the ER, Jeannie? Is that in the thought process? Is it in the works at all?
That is not being actively discussed at this point. It's something that should be evaluated. We are moving into our strategic planning process in the next couple of months, and perhaps that topic will resurface, but I don't think that that's on anybody's short-term plans of key strategic objectives that we need to follow through with.
Cheryl Brown is a slight, soft-spoken woman who has a passion for reading, and she's been able to take that passion and share it with others. Cheryl heads up the Smart Reading Program for the South Coast region of Oregon, basically the coastal area from Reedsport to Brookings. And what's SMART? Well, SMART is an acronym for Start Making a Reader Today. The Smart Reading Program focuses on younger kids from pre-K to third grade, and the idea behind it is to give kids the same passion for reading and for books that Cheryl Brown has. And the good news is, Brown says it's working. Kids really love the program.
They love it. They look forward to Smart Reading Day. They want to know if their volunteers are coming this day. They want to know where their volunteers are. And when they know it's Smart Reading Day, then they can just hardly wait until they come either into the classroom or our site coordinators come and get them from the classroom and take them to the smart space.
You heard that word, volunteers. The SMART program runs on volunteers, and they all bring that same passion for sharing a love of reading that Cheryl Brown has. Each SMART volunteer reads one-on-one to the same students once a week for the entire school year. Brown says that's so the kids get to know their readers, and the reader volunteers get to know the kids.
SMART is very fortunate. We have a strong volunteer base. Statewide, we have a force of 5,000 volunteers continually each year. Here along the South Coast, from Reedsport to Brookings, we have a band of 176, 280, 185. You know, that fluctuates a little bit. So we're very, very fortunate. The reason we are fortunate is that volunteers stay a long time. In our area in South Coast, we have one volunteer that's been with SMART since the beginning of SMART, since 1992.
Brown says there are many SMART volunteers who have been with the program for 20 years or more. And she says volunteers stay with SMART because, of course, they love kids. But it's also because they can see the impact they make on those kids from the beginning of the year until the end. They watch those kids learn to love books and to become readers.
That they could see an impact they made from the beginning of the year to the end. And that's exactly what a volunteer wants to do, is to know that the time that they're giving is making a difference. And it does.
Barbara Bronstein knows exactly what kind of difference she's making. Barbara is a site coordinator for the Smart Reading Program here in Brookings. She and her partner Bonnie each oversee more than a dozen volunteers at Calmeopsis Elementary School, all of whom read with three kids each on Smart Reading Day.
There are 15 volunteers per day?
Yes, I have 15 and then she has 14.
Wow.
There's one volunteer that comes on both days because she just loves it. We read with almost 90 kids.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
I know. I start at 11:40, see two groups, then we have a recess from 12:20 to 12:35, and then one more group comes in after. And that gives me and the volunteers a chance to go over stuff. It didn't used to be that way.
So you're here for like an hour and a half, and that's
yeah.
it? But an hour and a half of really good quality time with the kids.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, we get it done in an hour and a half.
Well, it's almost SMART reading time at Calmeopsis Elementary, and we're waiting for the kids to come in and read. SMART site coordinator Barbara Bronstein has brought me to the SMART space. It's a colorful classroom with rugs on the floor, lots of small chairs, and low tables. There are several clear plastic containers stuffed with books, and Barbara is busy looking through them.
Oh, I found a Star Wars.
Ah. You put books out for them to read with you.
Right.
And they choose.
Yeah. I lay out all these books.
It's noisy and energetic when the kids come in.
Hey, guys. So come, let's go to the reading room and I'll tell you what we're all about.
And after a few minutes, Barbara and her student get comfortable.
What about you, darling? You want to be on the chair or in the ground?
Okay.
Well,
but we have to move the books out of the way.
Well, let's do that. You want to help? And we're going to be gentle with the books because we want to show respect for the books. Perfect.
Of course, the idea behind the Smart Reading Program is to get kids to love to read, so Smart makes sure that there are plenty of books in the classroom for volunteers to read with the kids, but also that there are books to be given away so that the kids can read at home by themselves or with family members. And something really wonderful, every single book the kids take home from SMART is a gift. There's absolutely no charge.
And so twice a month, they'll just pick out books that they want to read, and then they put them back, and then they go back to the classroom. But on the giveaway day, they get to take a book home, and we have to make sure they have their name in it, and then they bring them back to the... Everybody has a backpack outside their classroom, so they have to put their book in their backpack, and then they go back into their classroom. That's the deal.
Because otherwise they would be sitting and reading and playing with their new book.
Or leaving it in the classroom and forgetting it. How does a flamingo keep warm? Because see, look.
Because they put their feet in water, and the feet takes up the water into them.
That's a very interesting idea.
If you're interested in finding out more about the SMART Reading Program, you can do so by going online at GetSmartOregon.org. Again, that website, all one word, GetSmartOregon.org. Research shows that kids learn best when they're well-fed with good food. Blueberries, for example, are great for short-term memory boosts, and harvesting and eating fruits and vegetables in season is the very best way to get the very best nutrition. And there's no better, fresher way to get those fruits and veggies than from your own garden. The folks at the Brookings Harbor Garden Club love to talk dirty and remind you that March is a month of real transition in the garden. Paul Otto is a Garden Club member and says it's now or next year when it comes to pruning your fruit trees.
If you haven't completed your fruit tree pruning, this is the last month to do so before bud break. Aim to remove all long sucker growth and space branches for maximum sunlight. Stone fruits bloom on last year's growth, but apples and pears bloom from spurs, which are short growths and can be many years old. Feed all fruit trees now with an organic fertilizer. In the vegetable garden, peas are now best direct sown in beds. Give them maximum light and be prepared to stake with canes or any branchy material so they can climb and attach via tendrils. Onion seed and potato starts are also good to go now. If you want to grow leeks, I find it better to sow the seed in a large pot, and when the leeks are 6 to 8 inches tall, transplant them to a bed and plant deeply so that you will have maximum blanching effect on the edible portion of the leek. Most of us will have small branches and debris to clean up after winter storms. On warm days, rake out beds and apply a layer of mulch. Place over perennials and around shrubs to inhibit weeds. Hold in moisture for summer and to feed all those soil organisms for a healthy, sustainable garden. If you're growing hellebore cultivars in your borders, they will be in peak flower this month. They also will have small seedlings germinated around their crowns, and these seedlings are best now transplanted during moist, cool weather to other parts of the garden. If you have enough hellebores, remember to deadhead the plants as the flowers fade to eliminate self-sown seedlings, which can get out of hand very quickly. Feed all herbaceous borders now with an organic fertilizer. Many of you will be enjoying spring bulbs in gardens around town. If you have gaps in your borders, make notes on what bulbs could be planted there and plan to order more bulbs this summer. Narcissus, hyacinth, Dutch iris, and Spiraxis perform well in our climate, but if you want tulips, you will need to chill the bulbs before planting. Finally, on nice days, get out and enjoy others' gardens. After the wet winter, we all need to feel the warm sun in our face and see new ideas. There is no better place to wander than our own botanical garden, where you can get great ideas on novel plants and planting combinations. The garden is located at the corner of Highway 101 and North Bank Chetco River Road. Volunteers are available on Tuesday mornings to answer questions, and all are welcome. Happy gardening!
Something to keep in mind when planting your garden, pollinators. You know, bees and butterflies. Pollinators, like the monarch butterfly, ensure you'll have a bounty of beauty in your garden. Without them, we wouldn't have fresh fruits, veggies, and beautiful flowers. You may already know that Brookings is a monarch city. You've probably seen the signs at the north and south end of town on the 101. Well, being a monarch city means a whole lot of folks here have created monarch way stations by planting milkweed in their gardens. Why? Well, it's what baby monarch caterpillars eat before they transform into beautiful pollinator butterflies. You can find out all about milkweed, monarchs, and more during the month of March at SWOC, Southwestern Oregon Community College. The Brookings, Oregon Monarch Advocates will hold a series of mini-classes as part of the SWOC and Beyond program. Those classes will happen Thursday afternoons in March from 3 to 4:30, and all of them are absolutely free and promises to be really fascinating. You'll learn about the life cycle of the monarch butterfly, as well as the conditions they need to thrive, and that includes milkweed. We're told that they will sell milkweed starter plants, so you can plant them and have plenty in your yard to attract the monarch moms this summer. They lay their eggs on milkweed, guaranteeing their baby caterpillars will have plenty of fresh, local milkweed to eat. Well, we humans don't eat milkweed, but we should all eat fresh and local food in season. And that's exactly what Otterbee's Market's Kathleen Dixon is all about. She's got the inside scoop on what's growing and what's going on at our local farms and businesses. And right now, Kathleen is all about fresh local cheese.
And I have discovered over the course of the last few years that we have three premium cheesemongers in our area within 150 miles of Brookings. Rogue Creamery has award-winning blue cheeses. That's their specialty. And when we switched from just selling at markets and with a CSA to our online store, we decided it was time to start carrying Rogue Creamery cheese. So we picked up some of their fabulous blues, and then they have a couple of specialties, one called La-Di-Da Lavender and another called Hop Yard. Real fun cheeses. I also knew I wanted to carry Rumiano cheese. Everybody knows about Rumiano cheese. They're just down there in Crescent City, and they make their fabulous, famous Jack cheeses. That's what their specialty is. So they have a pepper jack and a regular jack and a garlic jack and a this jack and a that jack. I mean, they've got probably 20 different kinds of jacks. And then the latest find, when I was driving through Bandon, and I'm like, why aren't we carrying Face Rock Creamery cheese? So I stopped in, and turns out their specialty is cheddars. And I've picked up four different cheddars that I'm offering on Otterbee's. A cranberry walnut using local cranberries, I love that. One called Alpine Pepper. And then there's one called Vampire Slayer, which is a garlic cheese. I hear it's pretty garlicky. I haven't tried that one myself yet, but I'm a garlic fan, so I'm sure I'm gonna love it. And then I picked up one of their mild aged cheddars. So, as a local Brookingsite, if I think I said that right, you guys have the option of at least three different local cheeses, all found within 150 miles of Brookings, all specializing in a certain type of cheese, and all available pretty much year-round. So my question is, why would you buy anything else?
Kathleen Dixon has more information on what's fresh and local. You can find out more at her website, otterbeesmarket.com. You've been listening to Fourth Friday. Fourth Friday is a KCIW News Magazine program made possible by a grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust and from listeners like you. Please consider supporting KCIW generously. You can find out more on kciw.org. I'm Lori Gallo-Stoddard, and a big thank you to Paul Otto, Kathleen Dixon, and Janice Openshaw for making today's broadcast possible. For all of us at KCIW News, thanks for listening.